Radio EcoShock.
From the young face of protest at Clackwood Sound, British Columbia, through the fight for the Great Bear Rainforest, and now co-director of the Climate and Energy Campaign for Greenpeace International, activist Zipporah Berman captures it all in her new book, This Crazy Time. Here is Zipporah speaking at the book launch at Capilano University in North Vancouver, Canada on September 7th, 2011.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Fiona Black. I'm the Director of Programming here at the North Shore Credit Union Center for the Performing Arts, our newly christened name. There are lots of people that are still fighting the good fight, and there are those who are working to save Earth, to expose lies and corruption, and to try to get that onto the political agenda of today. Zipporah Berman is one such inspiring individual who spends her days lobbying, strategizing, researching, campaigning, and doing everything within her power to effect change and make a true difference in this world. Now, a little bit about Zipporah. She's got an impressive resume for sure. She's a founder of Forest Ethics and Power Up Canada. She's currently Greenpeace International Climate and Energy Co-Director. She's been designing and managing environmental campaigns for 18 years now. She's known for her role in coordinating the largest civil disobedience in Canadian history at Clackwood Sound in 1993, during which she was arrested and charged with 857 counts of criminal aiding and abetting. Yeah, I don't know, how do you count that high? That's how tough she is. She's also known for her work in creating unlikely alliances with the logging industry and major paper and wood consumers that have resulted in the permanent protection of millions of acres of old-growth forest. She is one of the experts in Leonardo DiCaprio's documentary, The 11th Hour. The Royal BC Museum has included her in a permanent exhibition as one of the 150 people who have changed BC's history. She has been lauded as Canada's Queen of Green in a cover story in Reader's Digest and was recognized by the Utna Reader as one of 50 visionaries who are changing your world. It's quite inspiring words, to say the least. And I've just learned that Zipporah has just returned home to Vancouver to live. So this is a real homecoming. Please give her a grand welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Fiona, and Capilano College, Capilano University. Oh, I did that on Bill Good, too, for welcoming me here tonight. You know, it's really funny to be talking about this book in this city, you know, in this room, with so many of you who lived all of this with me. I think it's going to be a very different talk than I'd give in Toronto or other places. Almost 20 years ago, I came to BC because I'd seen an image of the temperate rainforest in a geography class. And, you know, I knew about Brazilian rainforests. I didn't know anything about temperate rainforests. I didn't even know Canada had temperate rainforests. And I came here with $200 in my pocket and a backpack and a new pair of hiking boots. And, you know, little did I know that that trip would change my life and would be the start of an incredible wild ride that continues today. I was really lucky to be engaging in BC forest issues at that time in our history, at a moment when those issues had traction, had a resonance. You know, it was a tipping point, you know, in British Columbia history, in large part because of the decades of struggle that had gone on before, because of battles that many of you remember in the Stein and Carmana and the Walbrin, because of the decades of protests in Clackwood Sound before that unbelievable summer. I was incredibly lucky to meet some of the most creative and dedicated environmental campaigners in the world who became my friends, who became my mentors. One of them even became my husband. And together we took on the logging industry and later its customers, some of the largest corporations in the world. We organized the largest blockades in Canada's history, international boycotts and cross-border brand attack campaigns. They resulted in high-level negotiations that we were completely unprepared for with government and First Nations and industry, and resulted in protecting millions of acres of forest and changing the rules of the game in a lot of ways. We taught each other as we went along. We inspired each other. We kept each other healthy. And we were very lucky to have found each other. I wrote this book because, you know, in part because of an experience I had in Copenhagen at the United Nations climate change negotiations, when I met with the youth delegation there, who were so disheartened. They were so upset and so sad, and they just didn't know what to do next. So many of them had organized for so long to get to that moment, you know, to bring attention to climate change, to bring attention to Canada's, you know, incredibly dismal record, and they didn't know what to do next. And what I found with those kids and with a lot of the youth that I talked to across the country is that they don't need to be convinced that climate change is happening or that, you know, we need to address environmental issues. They know. They've grown up with it. They need to be convinced that they can make a difference. They need to be convinced that they matter and that their opinion matters. And those kids needed ideas and stories and mentors. You know, you can get a degree to become a lawyer. You can get a degree to become a doctor. You can get a degree to become a teacher. You can learn those things. But, you know, trying to figure out how to be a muckraker, it's just not really quite as easy. What do you do when you get up in the morning when you haven't been able to sleep because you are so upset by that documentary you saw about the tar sands? What do you actually do? Who do you engage with? How do you be an environmental campaigner? And can anyone be one? You know, I wrote this book because I'm hopeful that by sharing my experiences, some tremendous successes and some really spectacular failures, that by really honestly exploring the issues, the strategies and the tactics, then I can help those youth leaders figure out what to do and inspire others to join them. You know, I had a friend say to me the other day, so, I mean, really? Did you talk about things that didn't work in your book? And then I had another friend call me who was just reading it going, you told the underwear story? You told it to everyone? Karen's looking at me going, did you get to that part yet? I really told the underwear story. All right, I have to digress and tell you the underwear story, because it really is one of those moments where you work so hard and you think you're like, you know, on top of the world and you're going to address the issues, and then it just doesn't work. And sometimes it doesn't work. In 94, 95, after the Clackwood blockades, you know, the industry had been very successful in making it a kind of a jobs versus environment issue. You know, it was jobs or trees, and you had to be for one or the other. You know, our research was showing us that it really wasn't that, of course. You know, that we were exporting raw logs, that if we, you know, if we had more value-added manufacturing in the province, that we could log less and have more jobs, and we wanted to show the world that. And so we decided we were going to blockade a raw log shipment here in the Vancouver Harbor and really draw attention to the issue. And we worked, we did our research, we produced a report, we went and had long meetings with the Pulp and Paper Woodworkers Union and created a bit of a coalition. And we decided what we'd do is a bunch of us would blockade the raw log shipment, and then others would come to the dock, and we convinced the PPWC to come and support us with their picket signs on the dock. Told the media that, you know, they should come to the dock and they would see something. But, you know, we couldn't tell them what it was, or we wouldn't actually be able to stop this raw log shipment from leaving the harbor. And so the day happens, and most of the time in the protests in those early days, you know, I was a spokesperson, but I wasn't actually. And this time I was like, I was determined. I was going to do it myself. And so we, around the corner from where the log, from where the ship was being loaded, we got into our Zodiacs and, you know, wearing the Greenpeace suits, the Tyvek suits, Greenpeace on the back, and we're ready to go, and we start the Zodiacs, and one of them won't start. And so we're, you know, playing with the motor, and we're trying to start. And, you know, this is in the day before cell phones. That's really how old I am. And so we couldn't actually call the people on the dock and tell them we were going to be late, but, you know, so they're all on the dock going, where are they? Where are they? And then the boat is like almost finished loading. And so one of our friends, who's worried that the boat's going to get away and the media are there and we haven't shown up, decides, I'll stop it I'll stop it myself. And so he strips off his clothes and he jumps in the icy water and swims over to the dock and climbs onto the logs, you know, and stands there and stops it from loading. And then he realizes, that was a good part, remember he didn't have a placard? And he was worried the media would get an image of them without the saying, you know, stop raw log shipments. So he jumps back into the water and swims back to the dock and gets a placard. And then he swims back to the logs and jumps on the logs with his placard, you know, and in his underwear, right? And so the media are filming all of this. And then, you know, we don't know any of this is happening because we're around the corner. And then we get the Zodiac started and we come around the corner of the harbor, you know, just like in the movies, you know, and we come in with our, and we don't see him because he's on a different pile of logs. And we come in and we scramble on in our suits and we chain ourselves and we hang our banner and we're standing there, you know, chained to the raw logs. And we look over and someone says to me, "Is there a guy over there in his underwear?" I think there is a guy in his underwear. I don't know what's going on. And we get arrested and we end up in jail that night and we're freezing and we're in jail and facing some pretty serious consequences. And we hear, down the hall, all these guys laughing. And then a little while later, the police chief comes in and he says, I couldn't help it. I taped it. Do you want to see the news?" And we're like, yeah, we want to see the news. I mean, that's why we do this, right? We want to raise the issues. And so he shows us the news coverage, and it's Terry Malevsky, you know, CBC. And he says, "And today, one lone protester in his underwear protested the shipment of raw logs, an unusual protest." And then it ends, you know, the coverage ends. And we're sitting there. We've all been arrested, and it's forever infamous as the Greenpeace underwear protest. That was didn't exactly raise the issues as we wanted to raise them, but I digress. The point is, you know, it's not always clear what you need to do when you're working on these issues, and there really is no silver bullet. And what I tried to do in the book is tell those stories and talk about the decision moments and what kind of criteria we used and what decisions that we made. And I didn't, you know, avoid talking about the hard issues, about working with First Nations, some of whom really didn't agree with us, about what it feels like when, for the first time, when your own community disagrees with what you're doing and what you should do about that. I'm really hopeful. What the book can do is give people some ideas and realize and help people realize that you don't have to be an expert. You have to care and you have to act respectfully and with your values. And if you do, and if you organize and come together, then we can all engage in making tremendous change. I also wrote this book because we simply can't solve these issues without more people engaging. And environmentalism cannot be the purview of a few of us who have the courage to jump on raw logs or the... And I'm not talking about engaging by more of us walking to work or changing our light bulbs. Of course, those lifestyle changes are incredibly important, but they're not enough. I talk a lot in the book about my own climate reckoning, of why I've moved from working on forest issues to working on climate and energy issues. And the reason I'm saying it's not enough for us to just change our own lifestyle is because the majority of our global warming pollution comes from heavy industry. It's really not enough to have better light bulbs. We need to have better laws. Our politicians will not enact those laws unless they know that we support them in making the necessary changes and that they understand the consequences to them for inaction. You know, after almost 20 years of meeting with government and running environmental campaigns, I've come to the conclusion that most of the time politicians care about two things. They care about money and votes, and we can affect both. So why aren't people engaging? People care. You're here in part because you care. I know from the polls that people across this country care, and now what I've learned since I joined Greenpeace International is there's a surprising alignment around the world, from India to China to South Africa, on these issues. People want clean, renewable, safe energy systems. We want to protect what's left of our wild places. We care, but most of us don't spend enough time engaging in the issues that will define our quality of life and our children's future. You know, it's funny, we wouldn't allow someone else to decide where our kids go to school, but we essentially defer most of the big decisions about their quality of life by not engaging in many of the critical issues. We read the books, we come to talks. You know, many of you will have read Manbiot's Heat and Flannery's Weathermakers and Suzuki's many, many, hundreds of titles, and those books will scare your socks off. And then we pack our kids' lunches and we balance our checkbooks. And for the most part, we don't wade into the debates because we feel like we're not experts. Because the issues are messy. The debates are messy. You know, I have 2 university degrees in environmental studies, and I've worked on this stuff for 20 years. And when I started working on climate and energy issues, I couldn't figure out what I was for. You know, we know what we're against. Coal, tar sands, it seems pretty clear. But what are we for? You know, I started wading into the issues, and the solution, I was told, was a carbon tax, and no, it was cap and trade, but cap and trade only if we auction the permits, and we need to have emissions reductions, and they should be at least 30% by 2020, but only from 1990 benchmarks, and what? And then we wonder why people aren't engaged. Yet, it's not really rocket science. If we're polluting more today than yesterday, then it's not okay. If we're not doing everything we can to build a clean and safe renewable energy systems and systemically shutting down coal plants, tar sands operations, and trying to electrify our transport systems so we get off dirty energy, then we're not doing enough. If we're subsidizing big oil like we're doing in Canada, you know, over the last 2 years, we've spent close to $2.5 billion of taxpayers' money giving it in subsidies and tax exemptions to the oil industry. You know, that's despite the fact that companies like Shell made $1 billion this month alone in profit. Public money should be going to the transition to a clean, sustainable economy. We should be making it increasingly expensive to pollute. We need to design campaigns that are accessible to more people. We need to inspire people to engage on these issues. You know, when I started working on climate, I met with a woman from the Prime Minister's office, and I said to her, look, this poll is showing that people care. People care about these issues. Why aren't you doing more? And she said to me, sure, people care. They care, but they don't really understand them, and they're not really engaging. So we're doing enough. And that's not okay. It's not okay for those kids in Copenhagen to be ripping Canadian flags off their backpacks because they're so embarrassed to be Canadian. It's not okay that Canada has some of the weakest laws in the world, that in the last Climate Performance Index we ranked 57th out of 60, one of the weakest countries in terms of climate and energy laws. We came just above Saudi Arabia. It's not okay that in the center of Canada, in the Alberta tar sands, we're spewing out 1.5 billion liters of toxic water into open-pit unlined lakes that you can now see from space. So in this crazy time, I've tried to pull back the curtain on the campaigns I've been involved in to invite people to step inside and to share the journey of how we decided to do what, when, and what impact our decisions had so that more people will wade in and organize. I decided to write this book because there never has been a more important moment in our life, in our history, to organize. When many of us started working on these issues, it was because we cared about our forest. We had a soft spot for big trees or bears. Today, when the United Nations says that climate change is the moral challenge of our age, you know, when the United Nations says that today more people lose their homes around the world because of climate change than war, then it's no longer an environmental issue. It is, in fact, the moral challenge of our age. Last year, 1 million people in Sudan were displaced because of floods. This year, millions are starving. We've now experienced a 50% increase in violent storms since 1970 because we've been treating the atmosphere like an ashtray for way too long. Global emissions have increased 70% since 1970, and we're currently experiencing the warmest climate in 420,000 years. And in fact, the last 10 warmest years on record are since 1990. So what does it all mean? We're told that if the average temperature stabilizes between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees, we can expect up to 2 billion people will face water shortages in our lifetime. Yet we know, given the extent of the warming and the rate of emissions increases, a 2-degree warming is now unavoidable. So the UN tells us that by 2020, 9 years from now, agricultural yields in Africa will be reduced by 50%. One of the stories that I tell in my book is about meeting the chief negotiator of Liberia on a plane on the way to the United Nations climate negotiations in Copenhagen. And he asked me, you know, what was happening in my country, and I told him about some of the tar sands debate. He knew about the tar sands. Then I told him about, you know, some of the debates we were having here in this province over renewable energy, over IPPs, the debates in Ontario over wind farms. And he looked at me with the saddest look in his eyes. And he said, it's nice that you still have time for those discussions. In my home, people are dying every day because of climate change, and thousands more are struggling to get access to water, let alone electricity. He seemed less a negotiator than a mourner. I went to Copenhagen before meeting him on the plane, full of hope. In part because, of course, Obama had just been elected on a platform, you know, where he said the future of the planet comes from a willingness to address the challenge posed by carbon pollution. Then he came and negotiated an agreement so weak that the chief negotiator from Sudan, who headed up the G77 group representing 130 countries, compared the deal to the Holocaust. I was in Copenhagen when he said, "This document threatens lives and the livelihoods of millions of people in developing countries and the existence, in fact, of the African continent. This agreement condemns Africa and turns it into a furnace. You are asking Africa today to sign a suicide pact." And the Canadian government there played a role way above its weight, again opposing progress to reach an international agreement. I wrote this crazy time because there's never more an important time to try and engage more people in environmental campaigning. Because as I talk about these climate issues now around the world, since I started working with Greenpeace International, I constantly hear people talking about, you know, the million people in Sudan who have lost their homes, the 1,000 tornadoes in the U.S., the 536 people lost their lives this year in the U.S. due to tornadoes. That's more than the number of deaths from tornadoes in the last decade. And people talk about it as a tragedy. The tragedy of losing over 10 million hectares of forest here in BC because of the pine beetle. Everyone talks about it as though it's a tragedy. A tragedy is a problem that doesn't have a solution. We have the technology today to solve the climate crisis. A problem with a solution that is not being acted upon is not a tragedy. It's a scandal. And it's a scandal today that our government has not put in place a single law to protect us against the threat of global warming. It's a scandal that we haven't acted, that people are starving because of droughts that were predicted 10 years ago and we know the cause, yet we're still debating. Perhaps the negotiator from Sudan is right. I have no doubt that if we don't engage today to the best of our ability, we'll look back and we'll regret it. I truly believe that we still have a chance to make the changes we need to make, that a different future is possible. But while we sit on the sidelines, the fossil fuel industry is organizing. They're funding doubt and denial. Big companies like Exxon and the Koch brothers, Shell, Syncrude, big utilities like Eskom in South Africa, these companies are lobbying against stronger laws. They're organized and they're winning. Last year, Greenpeace did a study that proved that Europe wouldn't need oil from the tar sands or from the fragile drilling in the Arctic if it passes the vehicle efficiency regulations that are already proposed, that we already have the technology to meet. Yet companies like Volkswagen are opposing those vehicle efficiency regulations, even though they have the technology. They're just refusing to put it in their cars because they won't make as much money. I wrote this book because we're living one of those tipping point moments like we did in Clackwit in the 90s. Globally, we are living a tipping point moment on energy issues where we now have the opportunity to push that ball over the edge. Since 2004, the annual global investment in renewable energy capacity has increased by more than 700%. You know, last year in Europe, there was more renewable energy built than there was infrastructure in fossil fuels. Last year and the year before were the first years in human history that the new investment in wind, in solar, in renewable energy exceeded the combined investment of oil, coal, and nuclear. We are living globally an incredible tipping point moment. By early 2010, more than 100 countries had some type of policy or law related to renewable energy. This compares with only 55 countries 4 years earlier. China is now building roughly one windmill an hour and has become the largest investor globally in clean energy. So this is a tipping point moment, what my friend and mentor Joanna Macy calls the great turning. So how do we figure out what to do? There's no silver bullet. There's no one road. There's no one strategy or tactic. My son Quinn tells me that the best strategy, and I think he learned this from computer games, is that if you can't win, you have to figure out how to level up. I hope this book inspires you to take the time every week to think of it as a practice, to figure out how you can help us level up. I think I'll close by reading just a short passage from the last page of my book. "When I started this work, I thought I had all the answers, but now I know that no one does. the best we can really do is listen to others and to ourselves. But then we need to make choices and act, guided by what we've learned, our capacity and resources, and our principles. There is no one roadmap for social change and no single way to engage in these issues. In the end, it's about creativity, commitment, courage, and a little bit of magic. Global warming is real, its agents invisible, its schedule unaligned with daily human timeframes. In a sense, we're all sleepwalking through denial, unable to grapple with the enormity of the problem and the scale of the changes that we need. I am sympathetic to the difficulties of building a new generation of environmentalism, of coming to terms with the compromises we need to make and the speed with which they need to happen. But the laws of physics have no such sympathy. Either we make the change or we're on the sidelines while half the world's species and far too many of our fellow humans are sentenced to oblivion. After attending the UN negotiations in Bali, I spent a week with my 92-year-old grandmother not long before she died. One day we were sitting in the hospital and I told her about my despair and she said, "Oh, silly. I don't want to hear anymore about how hard it is, how big it is, and that you don't know if it can work. When your mother was growing up, when I was having my 7 children, we didn't have a phone. We had a party line. We didn't have a car. No one had their own car. We'd just gotten electricity. We didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones. No one had even thought of them yet, let alone this raspberry you're always holding," she said, looking at my BlackBerry. She said, "I never would have thought that in my lifetime I'd be sitting here talking to my granddaughter about what the world was like, and it would be an entirely different world. The way we communicate is different. The way we move about the world is different. By the time I was an adult and having children, I had never met anyone who'd been on a plane. You need to hold on to the fact that the world can entirely change in your lifetime." So when I do this work every day, I'm holding on to the notion that one day I'm going to be sitting with my grandchildren, telling them about this crazy time not too long ago when we were destroying some of the last of the world's old-growth forests to make catalogs and toilet paper. This crazy time in our history when we clawed at the earth to get at the last of the oil. A simply crazy time in our history when we used to fill our cars with gas. And they'll barely believe me, because the world will be such a different place. Thank you.
That was Zipporah Berman speaking about her book, This Crazy Time, launched at Capilano University in North Vancouver, Canada, on September 7th, 2011. Find out more at zipporahberman.com. This recording was made by Alex Smith for the Radio EcoShock Show.